This sermon is by Bible teacher Daniel Litton, the featured speaker on the Peace to Live By radio broadcast. This is the complete sermon without edits for time. To hear more sermons from Daniel, visit peacetoliveby.org. You can also contact the ministry at messages@peacetoliveby.org. Now, here's Daniel Litton.
John chapter 4, beginning today at verse 27. Just then his disciples came back. They marveled that he was talking with a woman, but no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" They went out of the town and were coming to him. In our previous discussion, we navigated through the conversation of Jesus with the Samaritan woman at the well. This second well's locale was near Jacob's well, of which was a famous site for the Israelites. Time spent speaking with the woman revealed that Jesus was the Messiah, the one God has promised would come to save Israel. In fact, it has probably been realized at this point in reading the text that everyone seems to be looking for him to come, which also included the Samaritan people. Nevertheless, in the midst of this conversation, or we could say at its climax, the disciples return from their venture into the city to buy some food. That's what John had relayed to us in verse 8, that they had gone to buy food. When they arrive back, confusion ensues at the scene of Jesus talking with the woman. Perhaps the disciples thought he wanted something to eat and had been too impatient to wait on them to arrive back with the food. The understanding is that in Jewish culture, a Jewish teacher or rabbi would not speak with a woman, as it was believed at that time that women possessed a lesser understanding, which, at least as education would have been concerned, was probably true, since the women wouldn't have been educated as much. So for Jesus to be having a normal conversation with her would have been particularly strange and out of the social norm, and would explain the head-turning of the disciples. As is blatantly obvious, we observers know why Jesus was having the conversation with the woman, for it was due to the fact he wanted to share the truth with her, to share the truth of the gospel. That's the reasoning, and it's a beautiful picture presented to us that the gospel is for everyone. Specifically, not just for men, thankfully, or only for certain persons. In our world, the underlying background predicament is that everyone is in need of arriving at a knowledge of the truth. One could venture to dive too far into this scene, as some have undoubtedly done, and assume that Jesus is trying to tear down the social customs of the day and make interactions between the two, male and female, as the same. But in reading the New Testament epistles from the Apostle Paul, it becomes clear that's not what he's trying to do. It is rather expedient for a woman to act like a woman, to be a homemaker, for instance, and not even attend college if she would rather gear her focus on child rearing or something else. Within the modern American society, we recognize that the line has been blurred when it comes to the difference between men and women. Nowadays, both are expected to go to university and obtain a degree. Both are expected to work professional jobs. Both are expected to contribute equally, dare it be said, to child rearing, splitting the responsibilities 50-50. Let's give a bit of time for some to calm down. Yet these ideas are American in nature and not really based in the Bible, or based even, we could say, in the natural inborn character traits that God has given to women, for instance. All that wasn't just said, was it? Indeed, the Samaritan woman was impressed with Jesus' knowledge, and the description of things as pertained to her life he really couldn't or shouldn't have known. This so much so that she hurries into the city and to tell everyone who will listen. The scene goes to show the impact that Jesus was having on her, and the city folk, being familiar with the woman, must have believed what she was describing, her testimony about him, which shows people thought of her as an honest individual, since a lot of them venture out with her and march back toward where Jesus is and his disciples are resting. Verse 31, meanwhile the disciples were urging him, saying, "Rabbi, eat." He said to them, "I have food to eat that you do not know about." So the disciples said to one another, "Has anyone brought him something to eat?" Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap for that which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor." Jesus is on mission. The concern in his mind has to do with getting the work done that his Father desires of him, even overeating in this case. All of us common folk have experienced this at one point or another, right? We've all had the experience of being so engrossed in doing something that we didn't even stop to eat. Usually it is the job, the workplace, that is the focus. Getting so caught up in writing a report or strategizing something out or talking with people, food becomes secondary. Yes, we know what this is like. Well, Jesus took this energy and put it toward his work. Maybe some of us have, like him in this regard, with God-type works. Surprise wouldn't come over the mind if that were the case. As Americans, we are pretty versed in working hard. Well, at least a lot of us. It's even called the Protestant work ethic, right? Many of us know how to work hard, to put our hand diligently to the plow. Yet, eternal things were being dealt with here. And our work, in contrast, usually deals with earthly things. Jesus points out to his disciples that there is plenty of opportunity. He says the fields are white for harvest. Around every corner, there is opportunity for the gospel's sake, where we can slip something in there as pertains to God, or even have more of a direct conversation with someone about God thanks. Or, on the other hand, we let our light shine forth before others by not presenting ourselves like everyone else, by behaving in a godly way, a way which is different and refreshing from the norm. By doing God's work, as has already been mentioned, we are storing up rewards for ourselves in the next life, as Jesus referred to, receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life. It's a very selfish thing, and yet a good selfish thing. As we know, or should know, it's not that everyone's primary work is going to be focused on sharing their faith with others. All of us will probably make that effort at one point or another, but not as our predominant work. Later, the Apostle Paul will lay out the various giftings from the Spirit, and we will do our works within the church and perhaps without with the use of those gifts. God hasn't gifted everyone with the gift of evangelism, despite what many evangelical churches may try to get you to believe, to adopt. So no need for the unnecessary guilt trips and painful emotions for not meeting a certain quota in gospel sharing this week. Now, for those who have been gifted with that, the sharing of the faith will be a bit more prevalent, and there are rewards for such actions just as there are with any other gifting. The rewards are not dependent on the response. That's important. It's not just that you share, and if the person doesn't respond how you think they should, that then means there is no reward or no seed even sown. Oftentimes, we understand that a person has to hear many times before they even believe. And your action might just be one step in the process for that person finally believing one day in the future. That leads to the next point, which is that since believing in the truth is often a multi-step process, others have done work, and you may end up reaping the harvest of their work. This case presented before us today with what Jesus was teaching the disciples, he was noting how the Old Testament prophets had done a lot of work preparing the hearts of the people and trying to persuade them to believe. Why, even this Samaritan woman, a woman who had been married 5 times and was now living with a guy who wasn't even her husband, even she was looking for and anticipating the Messiah to come. Truly, we never know who is looking for the truth and who wants to believe or who just needs that final push to get them to the top. To get them to the point of realization wherein they arrive at a knowledge of the truth and believe in Jesus for the first time, or even come back to Jesus if they have been wandering about. That's the way it often works. Others work, and then somebody someday reaps. In a way, since we are all called in some way toward this process, we all have entered into the labor of those of the past, those who have lived before us, whether that's people in the prior 2 years, the prior 20 years, or the prior 2,000 years. After all, most of the disciples sacrificed their lives for the gospel, as in the Apostle Paul and others. The Anabaptists, for instance, understand this well, for they often bring to remembrance those who have suffered and died before them in their faith. But do the evangelicals understand this? Is it something that's brought to the forefront of the mind ever? Verse 39. Many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me all that I ever did. So when the Samaritans came back to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. They said to the woman, "It is no longer because of what you said that we believe. For we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world." It becomes necessary at this juncture to note that Jesus' mission was indeed to go to Israel first, that is, those who were fully or completely Jewish. And Jesus kind of broke with that in this scene, in his witnessing to the Samaritan woman, since she was only part Jewish. Again, Jesus is relaying that the gospel is for everyone, and God is calling all to be saved. That's the beautiful thing regarding the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's not only for certain select individuals or even for those who have been pre-elected to receive it. It's for anybody and everybody. Now, on account of what the woman was saying, many do believe. The description John provides is the following. He told me all that I ever did. Now, this is likely just a summary of what she was explaining, or the gist or crux of it. It's not that she just simply busted into the front of the tavern and yelled out a sentence or two, and everyone immediately got up and ventured out to the Messiah. That can't be it. John's a bit in fast-forward mode. It's more likely that she stood there in the tavern or wherever and told her story to them, and then they came out to see what this was all about. This provides explanation as to why Jesus was requested to stay in the city longer, for perhaps they wanted to see all that he would have to say. Still, it is interesting that they had believed so quickly, for it seems oftentimes people need more time to believe, yet they believed quickly. During the course of those 2 days, actually, we don't have anything recorded for us of what was spoken. Apparently, John's tape recorder broke and needed batteries. Maybe he got mad and threw it, breaking it. Yet, it would have been priceless if we could hear what was said. Perhaps Jesus explained the kinds of things we find in the Sermon on the Mount, though. Probably not in the same wording, since the audience in Matthew was for Jewish people. Who knows? How would have Jesus phrased things to them, a Samaritan crowd? But we do understand that whatever Jesus discussed, he strengthened the faith of those who believed from the woman's testimony, since John does record they now believe from hearing with their own ears. Enlightenment must have filled Jesus' speech, a pretty encouraging and motivating speech it must have been. The transition takes place now out of the story of the woman at the well, verse 43. After the 2 days, he departed for Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. Even though Jesus knows that it's probably not going to make a big impact, and perhaps he was returning for other reasons as well, he happens again to the region of Galilee, which would include Nazareth. Nevertheless, a welcoming ensues, but not in the way as we might be thinking. The welcoming seems more in line with the expectation of a mobile traveling show, like those in the old American West, for instance. People desired to be wooed and wowed, and likely weren't interested in the core message of what Jesus was preaching. Then comes the interesting statement by Jesus that a prophet has no honor in his hometown. The speaker himself can testify that this is experientially true, for the speaker seems to gain more interest now with those in Indiana, and even when traveling in the podcast, versus those who are already familiar with the speaker, from the people who know him, or even from his home city. That just appears to be the way it works, for whatever the reason. Speculation has occurred by some, in which the logic goes that because people know you well, know all the details about your life, and have seen you from a child, that they really can't appreciate what is happening before them. They can't cherish the person as special because they know everything about them and have seen them around for a long time. Verse 46. So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. When the man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." We return to the area which is still in his home area, where Jesus had done his miracle at the wedding feast. Remember that? We went over that in John chapter 2. These persons were already familiar with Jesus' working power. Now, this official mentioned in the text seems to be some kind of Roman official rather than a Jewish one, since John uses the word official instead of Pharisee or something like that. Some have pointed to an idea that the official's faith was weak, and that leads Jesus to comment as pertains to unbelief. Though the text doesn't necessarily tell us that. Safer, it would seem, is to say that Jesus uses the opportunity to try to get this unbelieving people, for remember, he was in his hometown, to actually believe through the works of signs. Perhaps Jesus was expecting the man to just ask for it to be done so that it would be done. Understanding is not certain as pertains to this instance. We do know that the official will believe simply on the account of Jesus' words spoken, as the text is about to show us. Continuing with the rest of the story, the official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew that that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Thus, a journey had been made by this Roman official, journeying some distance, in fact, in order to meet Jesus to ask of this request. Love shines forth on the part of this father for his son, and his willingness to travel such a distance to seek out Jesus. It's amazing what people will do for love, the great lengths they will go, no pun intended. People do things in the drive of love that they would not otherwise do under different circumstances with people they do not love. This action, then, the healing of his son by Jesus, not only leads to his own salvation, but also to the salvation of his entire household. Now, the thought has been among some theologians that the wife of the official might be the woman mentioned in Luke chapter 8, verse 3. There, Luke mentions one of Jesus' followers being Joanna, the wife of Cusa, Herod's household manager. So this account in John could possibly be where Joanna believes, if she is the wife of this official, and it was her own son who was healed. That certainly would explain her zealousness to follow Jesus. Continuing on, John chapter 5, verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred the water. Whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was healed of whatever disease they had. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going, another steps down before me." The focus for us shifts to the scene of a pool, and this is a grand structure. In fact, it is noted as having five roofed colonnades. So these would have been the same kind of colonnades that we see in present-day Washington. The backstory seems to be that at this pool, people who were in desperate need of help would gather around. Were they homeless? Some probably were. The text doesn't necessarily say that. Regardless, whatever the case, they would gather together at the pool. And the reason behind this is particularly interesting. John notes that the water of the pool would actually move at times. The belief was present among the invalids that the water was actually stirred by an angel of the Lord. The ESV Bible notes on the cause of the water moving that the explanation provided in the text only occurs in some of the manuscripts. This has led many to believe the explanation of the angel's actions was added later, and perhaps not by John. Yet it will be included here, since it has traditionally been part of the text, and just because John may not have stated it doesn't mean it shouldn't be part of the inspired word. Reread that again. It appears that once the book was canonized, it was there. Taking this description for what it says, we understand then that while the water moved in the pool, its moving was actually caused by an angel of the Lord, whose responsibility it was to stir the water. Obviously, he was invisible, but in the stirring, power is added to it so that a person would be healed. Perhaps God had the angel accomplish this task to foreshadow what the Christ was going to do when he came. Thus, it would be a preliminary blessing from God. Jesus, obviously having background knowledge of why the people flocked to the pool and perhaps divine knowledge of the angel's occasional action, flat out asked the man if he wants to be healed. It's not that he would have really expected the man to answer otherwise, but he seems to be setting up the scene for everyone, including the man, to comprehend what is going on. We know based on what Jesus is about to say, though John doesn't come out and say it, that this man has some type of difficulty walking. An issue exists that has to do with his ability to get to the pool in time when the angel stirs it. And it's really a heartbreaking scene. This is serious business we are talking about. We all have the picture of the child arriving at the candy store excitedly, only to find it is closed, or a child about to take a big lick of her ice cream cone, only to see the scoop of ice cream fall off onto the ground and the dog gobble it up. These seem like tragedies to us, but this is a real tragedy, a real tragedy. The man is about to reach for the water, about to get his blessing, and then someone touches it before him, and he has to wait, and wait some more, probably only to be beat out again. If the angel stirring the pool could have, it seems likely he would have healed them all, but that wasn't God's provision at the time. The time hadn't yet come. However, now the time had arrived. Jesus was saying to the man that he had a solution to his problem. Happiness certainly filled Jesus' heart when he was able to accomplish things like this. That aspect of it usually doesn't come to our minds, but it has to be true. Here is God about to bless someone and even answer their prayer. God is about to fix a problem for the man that's been around for 38 years. That's a long time. From Jesus' perspective, this man is his brother, his Jewish brother, a man of his religion, of his race. Verse 8, Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Jesus is quick to point out that the man isn't going to be needing that bed anymore. It's too bad we can't see the expression on Jesus' face when he did things like this. It had to bring that happiness to his heart. We know ourselves when we are able to help others in a big way. Often it brings that great feeling of happiness to our hearts. We understand that feeling, so Jesus likely had the same feeling. And Jesus isn't concerned with the day being a Sabbath, like we are about to learn as regards the Pharisees, who seem deathly concerned with it. Jesus' concern is on the heart of the law of God. And the contrast of rigorousness and following it without any heart. Regardless, the text also points out that the man is healed at once. It's an immediate transformation, something that happens right there on the spot. Justice doesn't seem to be done in the gospel movies we've seen where the person slowly regains his strength. Well, everyone is amazed and then realizes he's healed. That dramatic effect is for the movie. In real life, it happened instantly. Verse 9. Now that day was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed." But he answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk?'" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." Was it that Jesus explicitly told the man to carry his old bed because he wanted to take a jab at the scribes and Pharisees? Perhaps so, perhaps not. It could have been he just said it to him so that he wouldn't leave it there. Whatever the case, the scribes and Pharisees, for we can assume it was this group of individuals who John refers to simply as the Jews, it was this group who wanted to find something on Jesus, something they could fault him about. Evidence to try to disprove and discredit him. And as an aside, anytime you see a fellow preacher or fellow politician or fellow something trying to find something, anything at all to discredit the person on the other side, you know that really, that's not legit. They are just most likely jealous or competitive, which is really the same thing, and don't want the other person to succeed. That's a tall tale sign. Yet, poll had to be made, for after Jesus meets him for the second time and talks with him, he runs back to them and tells them it was Jesus. Obviously, fear is engulfing the man's mind, and he probably fears getting into trouble for carrying his bed. He doesn't want to be charged with working on the Sabbath. Despite this, Jesus is going to work good no matter what the day. Shop for him is open all 7 days of the week. The time is short, and this is why prayer matters. Don't miss that. Jesus remarked, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." The Father works within time. That work can only continue if there is prayer involved, continual prayer. Without that, the work stops. Anyway, let's consider in closing one thing that Jesus commented to the man in the second conversation where he mentioned, "Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." What does this mean? Does this mean that physical ailments like this are because people sin? Jesus' 12 disciples seemingly think so, for they will ask him later in John 9 concerning this. You remember when they asked Jesus, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" John 9:2. Certainly we know, or should know by now, that physical ailments don't mean a person is guilty of sin any more than a tornadically destroyed house means that a person sinned. Sorry, the speaker was in the middle of nowhere, Kansas, as he was writing this, it simply came to mind. Actually, however, the text does seem to imply that in this particular case, with this particular person, that sin in his life had led to the condition. That's what the text implies. We don't know why that's the case. We don't know if the person did something stupid and out of his stupidity ended up with a problem with his legs. Let's say as a child he took a dare to jump from a high elevation, or perhaps he was drunk and did something that caused this. Yet we understand from other places in the Gospels, even in John, as aforementioned, that physical problems don't equate to someone's sin. In this case, it appears so, but that's not a universal principle. And what's ironic is that even in this case, where sin seems to be the cause, Jesus still has compassion. What a picture of the heart of God.
You've been listening to Daniel Litton, featured Bible teacher on the Peace to Live By radio broadcast. To hear more messages from Daniel Litton, you can visit peacetoliveby.org. That's peacetoliveby.org. You can also contact the ministry at messages@peacetoliveby.org. This message is protected under copyright law, all rights reserved.